About a year ago, I had this incredible opportunity and pleasure to speak with a global company and their first-line sales managers. And at that meeting, I got to meet someone who's become a friend and someone who's incredibly impressive, Fergus Connolly, Dr. Fergus Connolly, in fact, who is a world-class coach, not just to sales teams, but to athletic teams, professional football, basketball, rugby, you name it. And I wanted to give you all a chance to hear from Fergus and his incredibly inspiring message about not just peak performance, which, you know, sustainable peak performance, and the human side of driving for peak performance and how we can make that happen for ourselves and the people we work with every day. And if nothing else, I just want you to hear his accent because it's amazing. Fergus, you good-looking stud. How are you, man?
It's great to see you again. Good to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm good. I just want to talk to you because I love your accent so much. It's like it's the mellifluous tones of your beautiful Irish accent. It's going to wash over me.
He does fanboy. He totally fanboys you, Fergus. You got to know that. We talked yesterday and he was like going on and on about Fergus the Great. I just got to tell you, because he does not fanboy a lot of people.
Oh, man. I thought I was the one with Irish charm.
My mom keeps reminding me I am Irish, but just it's like a quarter. Like by the time you get to my generation, it's not like full on. It's like I don't have the full Monty that like, you know, you do.
Yeah. Well, we're getting to hang out again in February as well.
That's right. A couple of weeks. Look forward to it.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. So remind me, where are you? Are you in SoCal? Where are you?
Yes, Orange County, so I've got the sun. No, maybe not as much as you, though, this morning.
He does look sunny. Fergus, I, for one, am very excited to get to know you. I've been stalking you a little bit, your TED Talks, your podcasts, and one of the things that struck me, obviously you've spent 20 years coaching some of the best of the best and some of my favorite teams, which we'll get into, and special forces, I love your frameworks, your ideas, but what really struck me and where I want to go today is that so many of your principles and your frameworks and your outlook, these are universal truths. They do not just apply to athletes. And, Brent and I obviously our audience is a lot of CROs and sellers and others, but I really want to focus on how some of these methodologies and ideas are universal truths and can be applied to anyone everywhere, even in our personal lives, because I find it fascinating. But before we get into that, I wanted to just start and say, how does somebody with a PhD in computer organization, computer optimization, end up coaching elite athletes and soldiers? Like, what happened? How did that work?
I could give you a really long answer, but the simple truth is I'm just fascinated by what does it take to win? Like, what does it take to be successful and then to be truly great? And, you know, it's funny you talk about methodologies and frameworks. When Brent and I first met in Houston, that's where the connection was, because as he was explaining, you know, this to me, and as we were sitting down and going through it, I recognized somebody who was looking at very, very complex ideas and creating a model and principles. And that's where the connection was. You know, the detail that comes later. It's like that saying that, you know, the techniques are many, but the principles are few. And so I thought that what Brent and Char were looking at were, they were looking at it as a macro and then reducing it down into principles that people can apply. And the techniques may be different. And one of the mistakes I made early in my career when I would go and visit great coaches or teams, I would walk away with techniques and I was missing the bigger picture. And that's the single biggest mistake that you see, even in companies and organizations. They get so caught up in copying a technique or a tactic and they're missing the overall, the model, like I call it the model that the principles fit into.
And I love that. And when you talk about principles and models, I look at them as universal truths. Do you see those principles and models as not just applying to success in sports or in business, but in our personal lives as well? I mean, do you see them that broadly? And can you illuminate us a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the starting point is, and Brent and I spoke about this as well, the starting point is, what's your definition of success? You know, so, and you have to be very clear about that. What do you want to be successful at? And then you work backwards from that, because it's funny, some organizations that I've been part of, there's one very big government organization, I'm not going to name them, but I'd done some work for them. And at the end, there were 11 or 12 people in the room, and I asked each one of them, okay, what does this organization do now? I mean, very successful. And every one of them had a different answer. One person said entertainment, another said education, another said research. And, you know, being very, very clear about what success is and working backwards from that, that has to be the starting point.
Brent, had you talked to Fergus about that particular piece before?
Yeah, you know, I think, Fergus, the question I always ask is of myself and anyone else is like, what if you don't know what success is, right? So Jim was like, so you have to start with like, what's my definition of success? What if you don't know? Is it too dark? I don't know. It's like, how does that work?
Let me give you a sporting example. If you own, let's say you bought a sports team in the morning, is your definition of success profit or titles?
Right.
Because they may not necessarily be the same, or there may not be a correlation between the two. In fact, if you look at, I think, the last five or the top five most successful NFL teams, I don't think any of them have won a Super Bowl in the last, you know, 10 years. So what is success? And being very, very clear about that, and being very clear throughout the organization, because that's where conflict then starts to happen, or, you know, unconscious conflict between an organization as a whole.
And when you work with people and you go deeper on that, do you find that, you know, obviously, you know, a player might have a different term, you know, idea of success than the defensive coach, than the, you know, head coach. But do you find that even working with one individual, they've never articulated that or thought about that, and you help bring that out? And can you tell us about that process?
Yeah. So even in the corporate environment, what you find quite often is that it changes, it flips. So somebody may have been working exceptionally hard, and their idea of success was perhaps recognition and ego and status in their profession. But then as they transitioned through it, then it becomes more about, how do I sustain a high level of success? And it's wider now, because they've got the people who are responsible to them, they've moved up, they've got families. So it's about, how do you sustain success at that level? Being successful is, I don't want to say easy, it's straightforward, push very hard and, you know, crank. And you can run any organization really hard for 3 years, but it's not sustainable. So how do you, and then the key thing above all is finding alignment with your people, and then your overall, the organization's overall goals. That's the ultimate, where they see a mutual success between what they're doing and their success in the organization. That's sustainable.
You talk about something that I call heroic compensation, and the idea that performance dependent on a few individuals in the organization isn't really success. There's a few individuals mistaking brilliance for a strong system. And of course, we see that a lot in corporate America, where you've got two or three top performers, and they're like, oh my God, we're brilliant. And I could see how this would, you know, manifest on a top team. Oh my God, we got Michael Jordan. We're going to win every game. We've got this person. We're going to win every game. Can you give us an example of how you've seen that playing out and how that affects what you're talking about sustained success? Because I see a correlation there. And Brent and I see this all the time in organizations, where you've got five or seven top performers, maybe even one or two top performers, and the danger of that. But I'm curious how you see that in the sports world.
Regardless, it's sport and business, you see the same thing. And there's so many threats associated with that. One of the really common ones a lot of people don't speak about is that there's an attempt often to copy those one or two high performers and to copy the habits and behaviors that they see. And that's not possible. And then people fail to do that. In organizations, particularly whether they scale or whether they grow, then what happens is you've not educated or distributed decision-making or leadership. So as the organization scales, you're not scaling the skills that are necessary, particularly around decision-making. And this is where having a sustainable model becomes so, so critical. Not to mention what happens if one of those elite or high performers leaves. Well, what do you do then? You've lost domain knowledge, you've not lost brilliance, and you've also lost, or you realize you've had an illusion of brilliance perhaps associated with one or two people. So there's so many risks and threats with that. I'm sure you guys have seen it so many places.
But Fergus, what's the best sort of connective tissue, right? Across, particularly to your point, as you scale, you got to keep everyone on the same page and sing from the same song sheet, all those other wonderful metaphors we all use all the time. But is it, and we can say, what's a common vision, but it's a common purpose. It's all this stuff just seems so abstract. I could keep everyone, and I've been in companies where like the way that we keep this thing all going in the same direction is just like we define a very rigid process and make sure that everyone complies with the process, right? Then I've been in other companies where there's almost no process, but the common interstitial tissue, the connective tissue is this vision and a set of just core principles that we all believe in, but we kind of manifest in slightly different ways. How do you think about it? Is it all of the above? It's none of the above. Is it a set of metrics? It's like sometimes it's just a dashboard, right? So we're gonna manage to these numbers, and like come hell or high water, we're gonna get to those numbers, and everybody kind of just figured out. But we're gonna celebrate when we collectively as a team cross the finish line and hit that that particular bar. But it's this weird sort of voodoo is somewhere in between all those things. Maybe it's none of those things. Maybe it's all of them. Maybe it's one in particular that you'd point to. But how do you, particularly to your point, as you scale, what's the secret sauce to keeping everyone together?
I think one of the traps sometimes we fall into is we assume that humans are like machines. Humans are complex, adaptive organisms. They're incredibly complex. They're an organism, so they've got feelings and that. And this is the art of the art of science or the art of coaching. And the other point is nobody wakes up in the morning to come to work for company X or company Y. They're working for themselves, for their family, to support them. And that has to be recognized. And then, like I've said before, I think you were there, there's a quantitative and a qualitative assessment of success. So while you are driving towards metrics, and of course it's a business, there's a metrics, there's a qualitative aspect to that. Did you just reach target barely? Did you burn a whole load of bridges, to do that? And so this is where just measuring purely on the quantitative can be very, very misleading. So to say that it's just a purely objective approach, that's not going to be sustainable if you don't have the subjective assessment to allow you to determine whether or not this success is sustainable. That's the same with people, the same with the business.
So you're talking about that it's, and you mentioned that before, that it's one thing to achieve success. You're at the penultimate of your career. It's another thing to sustain it. And I've always wondered, what's the role? David Brooks, in his book on character, I don't know if you've read it, he has an incredible metaphor. And he talks about this idea of resume virtues versus eulogy virtues, right? Yeah. Resume virtues being the skills. You're able to make this many free throws. You're this strong. You have the skills of the game, whatever the game is, as compared to eulogy virtues, which some people might think of as emotional intelligence, but it's deeper than that, right? It's character. It's, what happens when you don't win? How much discipline do you have? How much self-awareness do you have? I'm curious, in your view, what's the role and the ratio of resume virtues versus these eulogy virtues?
Well, I think they're connected, because even when you're profiling athletes, you're profiling executives, you have an objective metric, which is the what. And then the next two questions are how and why. So how did they achieve the number? And that starts to inform whether or not it's sustainable. And then the other one then deeper is that motivation. Why are they doing it? And if you can understand those two things, now you start to understand again, is it sustainable? What drives them? How you can support them? Do they, are there other skills perhaps or other ways that they can continue to keep this metric high? Are there other skills that, you can help them develop so they can exceed it? And so it's, there's the what, but the question then always to ask is, well, how did they achieve that? And really another deeper question is why, what's driving them?
Can you give us a story or an example about a player? Everybody likes to hear about famous players anyway, but I'm sure you've got a ton of stories and examples about somebody who maybe didn't understand their own why or it wasn't aligned. I think it would shed some light on it for our listeners.
Yeah, I think in sport, I think it's very common. There are lots of players who, and I see a lot of commonalities across domains. But somebody comes into their career early on, and you measure their bench press or their speed or whatever, and they score off the charts, and they're hired straight away. Okay, so this is what they can do, but very often they're compensating perhaps for poor tactical awareness. I use the very same language with executives. They've got, X number of calls or X number of hours and they crush it. But they're compensating perhaps for tactical knowledge of the area of the industry. This is the classic salesman who can perhaps outwork somebody else. But that's not sustainable over a period of time. So how can you improve their tactical knowledge, their experience, and educate them, provided they're willing? And then understanding the why that's driving them, that becomes important because now you're talking to them about a long career. Now that's the process. So I have seen it tons of time, people who, with athletes, guys who can, bench press, the building, if you let them. And what's really interesting, I had this conversation last week. If you give a person a few hours off to work on one thing, just give them a few hours off, they're going to invariably be drawn to work on the one thing they're good at. Could be communication, could be cold calling, whatever. They'll work on that. Very few people work on the area. I call it a limiting factor, not a weakness, but that limiting factor that could allow them to have to compensate less. Tom Brady is a great example. Physically, perhaps not the most dominant athlete, but he never let his limiting factor fall below a functional minimum where it became a weakness, a true weakness or disadvantage. So that's what you're looking to develop in your high performers.
Okay, I got to know, because isn't Tom Brady perfect? Like, what is Tom Brady's limiting factor?
Some of his physical qualities might not have been the best, might have been the best runner, the fastest runner, the strongest, but he was always able to compensate for those with amazing tactical ability, tactical acumen, positioning. But even though perhaps physically he wasn't the fastest, he never let that become a weakness. So this idea that you can make somebody's weaknesses a strength is a myth, but you don't want them to fall below a particular point. And that's the key.
So I'd agree with that. That's this whole sort of, because there's a very, very long list, Fergus, of things I'm bad at. In fact, it's probably everything, actually, now that I think about it. But there's really interesting question of, like, how much time and effort do I spend in getting really good at it versus just like getting by on that and then leaning into the things I spike on, right? So there's a, which is a much smaller list, but it's easier to focus on. And one is that, so, I could kind of go both ways. Like, well, Brett, you're falling into your comfort zone. You're not growing. You're not expanding. You're not getting better, or you're not, or it's like, no, actually you're doing, particularly at your age, exactly what you need to be doing, which is focusing on the things you're great at, because that's where you actually can have the greatest impact. And surround yourself with others who are great at those other things. And I don't know about you, but this has been a tension in my entire professional career, trying to figure out which of those two directions. Where do you fall on that continuum?
Your strengths are your strengths. So if you're working with someone, those are their strengths, and that's what got you to the table, or that's what got you to the feed. So you have to maintain those and continue to improve them. But if there are those limiting factors, something that's holding you back, You want to improve it a little bit at least so it doesn't become a weakness. That's the key. So you could be the world's best quarterback, the world's best point guard, but perhaps if you're not a good teammate, you're not contributing, and that then starts to affect your performance. Okay, now that's something that we need to work on. That's something that now has become a limiting factor and has fallen below a certain point. And it's the same with everybody. It's helping people understand what those are and just doing a little bit of work to keep them above that functional minimum.
Is that counterintuitive to most people? And I know I grew up with a Gallup philosophy. I started with Marriott, and we all did Gallup, and this whole Marcus Buckingham idea of, you know, go with your strengths, manage your weaknesses, which of course I love, because then I decided, I'll just hire assistants to do all the stuff I want to do. But that's limiting, right? Because, you know, if you're going to be a star athlete or, you know, certainly run a company, you've got to have a little bit of knowledge about everything. And like you said, those limiting beliefs can really hold you back. I guess my question is, how do you assess which of those limiting beliefs you need to know a little bit about and which ones, oh my God, don't bother, it's not important?
Or even surrounding yourself, like Brent touched on earlier, surrounding yourself with people who are, that is their area of strength. And so that they, as a group or as a couple or as a team, you compensate. And that's why the best backroom teams or the best groups of people I've been around have brilliant arguments, but they know that it's all for that one mission back to what is success. And that in that closed circle of trust, they all think differently, they all have different strengths, and they're willing to trash it out and compensate for different perspectives that people have because of their strengths. And so building that high performance team around you or having those people around you, that's where it becomes so, so important. And you see, back to what you just said is when you have an awareness for some of the things that you're perhaps weak at, well, you can make sure that you have people surrounding you so that the team as a whole are successful. And that's really important. But it comes with conflict. And I know the term psychological safety is used an awful lot. I prefer the term performance safety. There's times when you need good arguments, like really strong arguments where people stand up for what they believe, but they all know once they walk out that door, that argument was purely in service of this overall mission that we've all committed to.
When I think about who you work with, you know, again, and who you've worked with, including my alma mater, the University of Michigan, Go Blue, right? These are literally world-class athletes, special forces. These are people who are at the very peak and you're trying to get them even beyond that. But I think of like for an everyday schlub like me, right? Who's just trying to get out of bed, survive the day, right? And it is exhausted. It's a little overwhelmed. There's like this, like, how do you find this balance, or is there a balance between push for excellence? At some point, it becomes hustle porn. Do you know what I mean? Versus, how do I distinguish between I need to push myself to be better always versus I'm exhausted, I need to rest versus I'm just doing this in a performative way to just be better for the sake of, you know, in athlete, because for athletes, there's a game, there's a score, there's a team. And I suppose in business, there's a scorecard and all that kind of stuff too. But at the end of the day, we're all just freaking human beings just trying to get through another day. Do you know what I mean? And for someone like you who's trying to do your best to squeeze the absolute pinnacle best performance out of everyone, do you find yourself kind of thinking through that tension of like, dude, I just want to just make it through the day versus I want to be the world's best? I don't even know what my question is, but I find myself struggling with that tension all the time. And how do you think through that? I don't know.
So
where am I going with this, Fergus? Save me for myself. Say something smart.
There's a few massive misconceptions that Brent, you made. First of all, having had the benefit of, you know, working behind the curtain, these are all just humans. They all have bad days, and some of them have good habits, terrible habits. You know, I've had world famous athletes, you know, break down and cry over things that they've been struggling with. And it's not always, you're right. Like, I mean, this idea of hustle porn, where it's about working harder and that's never going to lead you to a sustainable success. And it's being able to manage and understand what is going to lead to sustainable success. So the so if you wake up in the morning and you're tired and you need sleep, you need sleep. There's no, I think it's a Chinese saying, when hungry, eat rice, when thirsty, drink water. Wise men know what I mean. You know, you have to be aware of the situation that you're in. And in many cases, my role has been to help players and help people take time out and recognize the different types of recovery they need, not to do more. And in fact, with the people that you work with as well, they've got to where they've got to. No offense, they've got there without you. Same with me, right? They, you know, Oliver Mead, who is the old coach at the Chicago Bulls, said the only person ever made an athlete were their parents. You know, so as a coach, don't get carried away, you know, with your input. So your job is to help them sustain success. And sometimes it's about really about being more effective and efficient. It's not about doing more. I used to use this phrase all the an awful lot. More is of more. Better is better. So are you making things better, not just doing more for the sake of it? Because that becomes a trap that only leads to burnout. It doesn't lead to very critical it doesn't lead to any critical thinking. It certainly doesn't lead to creativity. And what it ends up leading to are to just systems and processes where people are being forced to follow rules.
God, this is so reminiscent of corporate America, right? Right? What were you going to say? I mean, you know, make more calls. It's like I call it pressing the more button, and the panic.
More is more.
And more is more.
Never is better.
Yeah. Sorry,
but Bob, but not at all. You don't need to be sorry, because I think it's like it speaks to everyone who's probably listening, which is there's this constant pressure to do that, to do more. And Fergus, we see it at the CEO level as much as we see it at the individual contributor level or at the frontline level, wherever. It's like there's this sort of expectation that, you know, I think what you're really preaching is a difference in kind versus a difference in degree. And I think most of us will gravitate towards a difference in degree, which is simply to say, if this much is good, this much is better, and this much is better. So I put in another hour. And it's like, and your point is like, actually, if we stop and think about like, what's a different in kind behavior? Like, actually, why don't we stop doing more of that and think differently about what we're doing altogether? It's probably the shortest path to what you've really hit hard here today, which is this idea of sustainable performance, right? Which is, I wasn't necessarily coming into this conversation expecting to talk about that, but I think that's actually where you've really taken it in a really powerful way, which is what we're really trying to do ideally in our lives and in our professions and in our leadership roles is not to achieve peak performance, but to identify a level of high performance that is sustainable. Maybe that's, is that a fair articulation of sort of how you think about it?
Yes, it was with the CEO last week, and he wrote it down. He was asking, I said, your work is not to work.
Yeah.
And he wrote it down his phone, but it was like his job is actually not to do more work. He has to work at doing less. In his instance, for a number of reasons, but that's probably one of the most common challenges for a lot of leaders. First of all, to be able to create the perspective to see what's going on accurately, and more importantly, for being able to deal with the people around so that it filters down. I don't want to use the term trickle down, but to filter down, and also I think the two greatest challenges. And people who overwork struggle with this is their problem solving is not true problem solving. They fail at identifying what the true problem is. So they're just producing a solution for something that is already there. And the second one is creativity and innovation. Anybody who watches sports, if you watch teams who have brilliant defenses, finding creative offenses is really, really difficult because, again, in sport, often the culture is to simply do more, and that's easy. So sustaining success is the goal because that allows you to continue. I remember working with a group of legendary rugby players a long time ago, and I used to joke with them, I can make you fitter, faster, stronger, I can improve your personality. But the one thing I can't give you is I can't give you experience. No. Anybody who's running a team has got very, very experienced people there. They have an inherent knowledge that they've gained that you don't want to lose because that's invaluable So you want them to sustain success. You don't want them to plateau, and you certainly don't want to burn them out. So what's your approach to that? How are you going to do that? That's certainly not by just, you know, doing more. Sherry, as you said, pressing the more button.
Yeah, you said something about creativity, and I see this, and I struggle with this in my own life, because there is a tendency to say, okay, I'm going to work harder at this one thing that I've been doing all along. And I am just now at my age starting to say, wait a minute, let's take some time off. Let's go on a hike today and let's look at the entire problem differently. Let's get a new way of approaching it. There could be a creative way to do less better. And what is that? And I do think that it takes stepping back. And I think there's probably some brain science behind this. I don't know what it is, but I guess it's that there's a different part of the brain that when we're relaxed and when we're unplugged, that's when we get the insights. So I guess this is very, very critical with a high performing athlete or a high performing CEO to just take the time to get other thoughts. How do you articulate that idea to people?
I tell them to let their brain surf. So it might be like you said, going for a hike or going for coffee. The only rule is always bring a notebook. Always bring a little notebook and a pen. And
yes.
And I gave Dean Curtis $1 million pen. Did he tell you this, Brent? Just for $1 million pen?
No.
NASA, when they were sending astronauts to the moon, I should have it here to show you as a prop, but they designed a pen that could write upside down, right in space, whatever, and allegedly cost $1 million to make. Now you can buy it for $50 now, but it's $1 million pen. It's really small. And I always carry one with me in a notebook, because when those ideas come, you might be having coffee. You might be having a random conversation with someone and they remind you of something, think of something. And you've just been allowing your brain to surf, to cruise through all of those things and those problems. And maybe it's something that the janitor said during the week that gives you an idea of how to reorganize or restructure something. And so being aware of those and then letting your brain surf through them, but you have to create time for that to happen.
That's exactly right. I have a totally change of topic, but it really, I was on my run, not with my $1 million pen this morning, prepping for this conversation. And you said something that really struck me. You talked about data versus information. And I love this. You said there's data that's useful, useless, and interesting. That really struck a chord with me. Can you elaborate on that concept a little bit? Because I think it's very, very useful for all the senior leaders that, you know, run that report, run this report, run that report. So if you could elaborate on that.
I describe like running a business, so that, you know, driving on a two-lane freeway. There's really, really useful information that you need right now to keep moving at a pace. And then there are things that are interesting that you might move into the slow lane. Now, you don't forget about them, but they're there. And when time comes in, you can dip in, you have a little bit of time, you can study and use that. And then, of course, you have information that's useless. And the quicker that you can identify those things, the better. Because what a lot of people do is they look at something and it's not relevant now, and they forget about it. I call that, you know, moving it into the slow lane. We will come back to it, and we're not going to forget about it. And sometimes you let a competitor explore that and run off with it or whatever and see how they evolve. And then you take the lessons from them, or you let something percolate. You see this with AI, for example, right now. So many people jumping into or pulling it into the fast lane and going with it. There are some ideas that need to be just percolated in that slow lane, and you can come back to it and see how they're relevant. Because you know, you don't want to be a magpie. For those of you who aren't nature experts, magpies get attracted to silver shiny things when they're making their, if you ever see a magpie's nest, it's got lots of glitter and lots of shiny things that it's been attracted to and picked up. So I say to people, don't be a magpie. Don't just get attracted to something because it's shiny and glitters. It'll be very, very careful about what you're drawn to. But you might want to park that in the slow lane. It's ticking over. and then you can come back to it in time. But that's the idea of, yeah, useful, useless, and interesting information or data.
I'm feeling so much like a magpie right now.
I suddenly feel embarrassed about my gold limit bed spread.
I know.
One thing about data, and I spent from my PhD then to working in sport, you've got all these numbers. One of the most important things is having that qualitative metric alongside a quantitative number. It's critical, because otherwise you're just looking at objective data without context, without an associated value. And particularly, you know, in sales or in business where you're dealing with humans, you cannot run just purely off objective, quantifiable metrics or data alone.
Tell me more. Give me an example of what that might look like.
I think, Brent, you were there for the 100-meter sprinter. Might set a new world record, but when you look at their sprint, their actual run or their race, they set a new world record, but their stride was all over the place. They were running poorly. They're at the point of injury, so they go the next time and they get injured. So it's, yes, the number is very important, but it's how they got there. So that's the result, but that's the performance is what matters. Salesperson, yeah, they hit target or they blew it out of the water this year. But if you go back and you look at the cause, you look at how they got there, running on fumes, it's not sustainable. The next year, because of all the pressure, they break down and they're gone. Or they're not a good team player, they're not a good member. Or as a manager or as a leader, team outperformed everybody else. So the objective, yes, was achieved and objectively wonderful performance. But you go talk to the people, the subjective, informative, that team's, you know, gone, burnt out. You don't see them again. So it's, the metric is important, but the context, the quantitative must also have a qualitative metric alongside it when we're dealing with humans. Who are your most important asset?
I hadn't anticipated coming into this conversation just how much you were going to land on this point of sustainability. And I appreciate it deeply. But let me just, for the sake of just argument, take the counter argument, because I'd like to hear you just really articulate it, which is, you know, look, if I can win this season and then then I burn everybody out, then I'll just bring in new people. And yeah, I mean, so maybe my performance is a little bit more erratic. Why is sustainability so important to you? Why clearly your work, your thinking, your efforts, your engagements are focused on that idea of sustainability? Make the case for sustainability. Why does it matter so much to you?
The really simple answer to that is because when I started working with elite performers, you came across people who had great performances. But then I started to ask the question, you know, what is greatness? And every single, my definition is someone who's been able to repeat it and sustain it. So when I ask you for the names of great athletes, you say Michael Jordan, Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, you know, in terms of coaches, they didn't do it once. They did it repeatedly. And that's greatness. And that then, you know, the All Blacks are great teams. That becomes the standard. So how do you sustain, a high performance and elite performance? And there are many factors, but you're right. Yes. In some organizations, if you wanted to, you could take any company, any one of you, and run it really hard for, you know, 3 years and then just replace everybody and try and go again. But you're losing domain knowledge and you're not actually solving anything. You're just repeating the same routine. So that's why sustained success is, it has to be the goal for any CEO, for any company.
You had a beautiful TED Talk. And for those that are listening and watching, started out a little slow. And I was completely transfixed with your humility, your conclusion. And it was this idea. Well, there were so many ideas in it, but the one I want to focus on is this idea of being a sheepdog and being a number two. And you have spent your career really being the coach behind greatness and being the number two behind people that are some of the greatest in the world. And it made me think of the film 20 Feet from Stardom, where you have all these backup singers that are backups to Mick Jagger and Jim Morrison and all the greats. And I see you as this person that gave gave the recognition and was the engine behind the talent of a lot of these great high-performing athletes. Did you ever want to be a number one? And how do you sustain your, what is your sustainability plan to keep going as you're building up the career of these great elite athletes and performers?
Oh, great question. I think Brent touched on it earlier, you know, this idea of you get up and you hustle. And early on, I thought, because you read an ESPN article or whatever, you see an interview and the idea you walk away from is just work hard, work, you know, do more. But you learn early on, no, that is not the secret. But sometimes you yourself, when you're helping others, you can fall into that trap. And so for me, I have to be very, very disciplined about how I take time off and invest time in recharging my batteries, particularly because, you don't often get a lot of calls with good news. You know, somebody's got a challenge, somebody's got a problem, and you're supporting them. So I have to be careful as well about taking time so that I can manage my time so that I'm able to address those problems. And yes, from time to time, be a sheepdog, but everybody who's a sheepdog needs a sheepdog as well. Whoa. Needs somebody that they can call on, somebody that they, that will answer the phone at 2:30 in the morning or when you're struggling with that. And that becomes really, you know, it becomes really, really critical. And a lot of leaders don't have that. You know, a lot of leaders don't have that network of people that they can rely on.
The thing that really that we're exploring on this podcast, I think, is something that's been implicit this whole conversation, Fergus. But but we can make it explicit, which is at the end of the day, it's you've said it already, which is that these aren't machines; they're human beings that you're working with, right? And when you seek to get performance, particularly sustainable performance from a human being, it's different than the way you do it from a machine, right? So that you have to, there's frankly, it's a lot more complicated, obviously, but tell me again, what's your PhD in?
Computer-based, I was just thinking about it actually, as you were talking, right? Computer-based optimization in manufacturing. And I was just thinking back to, you know, we would measure the number of revolutions that a riveter unit goes through because we could predict when it's going to fail. You can't do that with a human.
So relate your PhD to your current work now. It's like first of all, I mean, granted, so I have a PhD in German and linguistics. So we know that we live in worlds where your PhDs don't have anything to do with what you do for a living. But I would imagine it comes back in all sorts of different ways in terms of either things like as an anti-hero, or perhaps actually the focus of what you're doing. But so much of what you're doing right now is about human connection, and you've got a PhD in optimization of processes, right?
Well, my original degree was in woodwork and construction studies teaching. So
I love that.
Teaching kids, right? And so then, so I leave that and then go into programming and into data and analytics. So I shift from working with humans to working almost exclusively with machines. And then you start working with elite athletes and you realize, hang on, my teaching skills, pedagogy and connection and speaking becomes really, really critical initially. But then with the availability of data in sport, now I've got to use both. But this is where it starts to, again, not break down, but the gaps become apparent. And I see this so much in business today. You know, like sport 10, 15 years ago, we got this influx of data measuring human performance or measuring people. Same thing's happening on the corporate world. There's so much information, but there's a gap because you can't measure humans the same way as you measured machines. It's a very same thing I faced in sport. So it's knowing what it solves. It's knowing what it doesn't solve. I used to say that, sports science doesn't answer questions. It allows you ask better questions. And with data in corporate, that's really what it's doing. It's allowing you to ask smarter questions about why you got this result. And that's where the advantage is to be had.
And so let's kind of sum it up. What are the questions that if I'm a CEO, a head of any function really, and what are the questions I'm likely asking myself that would lead me to call Fergus and say, I need this guy to come in and help me figure this out?
I think, the one that scares me is when everything's going well.
Yeah.
when everything's going well, have you asked why and how are you achieving that? Because sometimes you can, you know, everything can look good, again, back to data and back to metrics, but you don't know why you got that result.
Or you have a suspicion that something's not right, right? Or perhaps like you get instinctively, it's like, yeah, we got there, but it didn't feel like we got there the right way. Maybe, I don't know. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you spoke earlier about, you know, high performers. The one of the real things about high performers is they don't see any difference between winning and losing. They interrogate the processes and the results with the exact same, back to Sherry at the beginning, as ruthlessness. Yes, it's important to celebrate and it's important to be able to sell. To sell this to the people, because sometimes, listen, you can have a bad year, but you did everything well. And so you have to be able to interpret that. Now, equally, you can have a really good year, but have done a lot of things wrong. So you need to remove the emotion from it, interrogate the processes and the results. And the best leaders do that. And then they determine how they're going to present that back to the team. Because again,
super cool.
some people could have struggled. But again, it comes back to confidence. No. You did things well. Some things outside of our control didn't work, but we're going to stick at this because we know that it works.
Right about now, I wish I was a professional athlete and I could work with Fergus because maybe I need to join the special forces. I don't know. But, Fergus, I could go on for another hour with you. I am so inspired by everything you said. How do people find you? I'm sure a lot of leaders in every aspect of life would love to get a little bit more Fergus. So how do we find you? How do people contact you?
LinkedIn or FergusComedy.com. I like that. A little bit of Fergus. Sherry, I might use that as a sales title.
I need me some Fergus. a little bit Fergus.
Little Fergus seasoning. That's right.
I need Fergus.
Yeah. Awesome, Fergus. Thank you so much for sharing your
wisdom. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Cheers.
What I loved about Fergus, there are so many things, but his calm. And I could feel how his calm is a real strength for him.
Yeah.
And he's the quintessential coach. His answers were short enough but you got everything you needed in that. And that he really gave an opportunity for there to be a dialogue. And I think it's very often people that are in that type of a position or who have that type of authority, they overspeak, but he was very judicious with his words and they were powerful.
It's interesting you say that because I've watched him work with sales leadership teams. This is how I got to know him because I was called in to work, do a sales kickoff where he was also there working with the team. And the first line sales managers that he was working with loved him and still do love him. He's still working with them. And they all get it. Like he walks in the door and it's like Norm from Cheers, like Fergus, partly it's the accent. It's just charming as hell, right? But it's exactly what you just said. He's got this sort of humble gravitas that I think is really, he almost forces you to lean in a little bit, doesn't he? And to kind of think about, sort of how you want to, what you want to take from what he's saying. It's almost like you have no choice but to engage because it's like, it's a little bit, you had Yoda over his shoulder, or a baby Yoda, I guess, technically, but it's like, you have to kind of lean in. It's like, it's almost like a Delphi oracle. It's like, I think I understand that, but let me kind of think through this. And then you realize, oh, there's a bigger narrative that he's building around, particularly around this idea of sustainable excellence. Mm-hmm. And that to me is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you get a chance to meet him and the first talk with him is this, you know, we're all pushing for excellence, or at least I don't know if we all are, but we're trying and we talk about it. But this, how many of us talk about sustainability the way that Fergus does with that much focus and that much care? And I think that to me becomes something that's critically important for all of us right now.
It really is. And there's so much talk about burnout and mental health issues. And you see it more and more, particularly with Gen Z and millennials and these cultures that, you know, where they're just looking at the wrong metrics. They're looking at activities. And you made a comment that I thought was interesting. This may have been when we had stopped about a leader that you know and that this leader drives so hard, and that's great, except that is this leader setting the stage for everybody else in the company to burn out? Because it may be sustainable for him, but it's not sustainable for most. And this whole idea about taking time to reflect, and you know, it is. I mean, when you're working out, you don't just do 86 reps. You wait a minute, and then you do some more reps, because the body and the mind needs to go into a state of surfing, I think he called it, or wandering. I'm sure my brother would have a neuroscientific term for it, but it's this idea of recovery. And I don't know about you, but I find I personally get my best ideas when I walk away from my computer.
Yeah.
And I think things through at a different level. The other thing I wanted to mention that he said that I thought was really interesting, and he said it at the end. Well, at the beginning, he said, I don't get called when things are going well. I get called when something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And he said, we need to start asking better questions. And that is, why are things going right? And I think that was really hit me between the eyes. And I think it's so important for teams, especially when they're killing it, especially when they've got 20, 30% growth rate, to say, why is this working? What are we doing right? Because otherwise, we're just unconsciously competent. And that's one of the things that we always do as a company. We always say, let's make the rest as good as the best. So we study the top performers and we say, why are they doing it right? Let's look at some patterns. Let's get some pattern recognition so that now we can look how we can help the rest be as good as the best. And I do think there's a tendency for all of us when we're doing well, not to stop and reflect. What are the three to five things we're doing that made us hit that quota or do well or nail that, you know, interview or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's a great point. The, because, you know, it's like, just kind of feels good. It's like, finally, something's going right. It's kind of on a coast. In some ways, it's almost like even more exhausting, though, Sherry. It's like, I just seem to be particularly negative today. It's like, man, it's like, if not going well, I got to reflect and root cause and dig down. It's like, and if it's going well, I can't even rest then. I got to actually, now I got to do the same thing. But I think that's it's the curiosity. The word curiosity didn't come up in the conversation per se, but it was kind of there the whole time, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Which is, he talked about creativity. He talked about asking better or different kinds of questions. And I think it's kind of your point too, which is, it is this natural inclination to ask, you know, why are things going the way they are? Whether it's really good, really bad, or somewhere in between. And that sort of open mindset of always looking for a better understanding of why things work the way that they do, such that you can do more of the good stuff and less of the bad stuff. But again, this idea of like, and so we could just do it a little bit longer. This idea of sustainability that he just really, really landed hard on, which in a good way.
Yeah. Oh, I loved it. Thank you for bringing a new person in my life, Brett.
Absolutely.
I love that. All right. Well,
can do for everybody. Cheers, everybody.